Welcome to the official Espigan podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hey there, boys and girls. Alex Nicely here. I'm speaking today with Georg Vogel. Georg comes from Austria. He comes from a part that has its own very special loyalties, the Tirol, where he works in Innsbruck in the group headed by Professor Thomas Miller. He's talking to us today about a presentation that he gave at the May 2023 Espigan annual meeting. That presentation had to do with, well, let him tell you.
It's FIC1 deficiency, that's the disease it's all about. We had a look at a case series of 6 patients that underwent liver transplantation and developed severe diarrhea afterwards.
Wait a minute. We're dealing with a bunch of people here in the listening public who aren't hepatologists. FIC1? What's that all about?
FIC1 is a gene. It's a protein, actually. It controls membrane integrity of the apical membrane in hepatocytes, so the membrane that limits the bile canaliculus, and it leads to disbalance and to improper bile acid secretion and cholestasis.
Aha, and what are the clinical sequelae of all these, besides itchy yellow kids?
Well, it's itchy yellow kids, and pruritus is not an easy thing for the kids to cope with, and the parents. But it also progresses to end-stage liver disease.
So there's injury, there's fibrosis, there's scarring, and eventually, whether it's hepatopulmonary shunting, whether it's portal hypertension, or whether it's just generally being miserable, these kids come to transplantation. But wait a minute, there's a lot of work been done with pre-transplant surgical modification of the plumbing. Tell us about that.
Well, your aim is actually to divert the bile acids away from the liver or from the intrahepatic circulation, meaning you take up the bile acids in your gut and recirculate them to the liver, and this is a circulation.
So you can do that by wasting the bile, diverting it externally.
Yes.
Through the gallbladder, through a roux loop. And what effects does that have on their general health?
Well, first of all, it depletes bile acids. You can, to some extent, prolong liver function and prevent or postpone liver transplantation, particularly in FIC1 patients.
And ameliorate the pruritus, yes?
Yes, the pruritus, but that comes at a cost that you, particularly when you do external diversion, you have to substitute fat-soluble vitamins. You might have at least digestive problems to some extent, but all that is better than the really, really bad pruritus.
Right. Well, I've met a couple of these kids who had FIC1 disease, and they itched themselves bloody. That's not an English curse. They frankly took off their skin with trying to scrape, get at the deep itch. And the parents don't get any sleep. The kids are miserable. And they come to you, I'm sure, saying, "Doctor, do something, anything." But it doesn't have to be surgery anymore.
Not anymore. Now you can have more or less a pharmacologic diversion by blocking the intestinal uptake transporter.
So the transport of bile acids,
exactly. And these, there are basically 2 drugs on the market for that. Both end with Ixibat in their name.
Why? Ixibat?
I don't know why.
It has to be bile acid transport in there somewhere. Inhibitor of bile acid transport, IBAT?
You would expect that, actually, but...
Okay, I'm just guessing.
I didn't pick the name.
No, okay. And you've tried these drugs. You've tried these drugs before transplantation and after transplantation. But what you wanted to tell us about in your presentation was after transplantation. Why is it necessary to block bile acid uptake in these kids after they've got a new perfectly working liver?
Because that's exactly the problem, that the liver is working fine and secreting bile acids as the liver should into a gut that probably cannot cope with that amount of bile acids.
So you're saying FIC1 deficiency alters the gut's ability to handle bile acids?
Yes. FIC1 is expressed also in the gut, and it has been shown that it influences farnesoid X receptor signaling in the gut epithelia. And this is important to manage the reuptake of bile acids and circulating them back to the liver, but also having the endocrine feedback loop for the liver to know whether the liver should produce more or less bile acids, depending on how much the gut is taking up.
So FIC1 gut is never challenged by normal levels of bile acids.
Before transplantation.
Before transplantation. And then the liver starts to chug away, operating its little bile pumps. This is the new liver, the implanted liver. And that bile is reaching the gut, and the gut says, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, what have we got to deal with here?
Yeah, the gut can take, so the expression of the apical sodium-dependent bile acid transporter, as it's called in the gut, the ASBT, is regular, and it's probably working. This is that is known, because otherwise the IBAT inhibition wouldn't work in the first place. So it can take up bile acids, but farnesoid X receptor signaling is independent of that and seems to be somewhat deficient. At least that's what we think the case might be.
That means that these kids, how do these kids respond then to liver transplant and to this gut? What are the clinical features of new liver, old FIC1 deficient gut?
So most of the patients respond with diarrhea soon after transplantation. So water diarrhea, which is assumed to be or has a collagenic component to it. So the increased amount of bile acids now secreted by the healthy liver or the transplanted liver would lead to diarrhea. It's the same effect that if you overdose erso deoxycholic acid or bile acids in general, it might cause diarrhea.
Well, here we have a problem. Here we have a problem. And I think the problem is you've got an ASBT that is working normally, meaning that those bile acids should be going into the enterocytes. And the enterocytes are not dying massively as they would if they were being poisoned by bile acids. So those bile acids are making their way through into the portal venous circulation, which means that if you take a look at the poop of these kids, then it shouldn't have high levels of bile acids. Have you done that?
No, but we will.
But you will. Okay, when you do that, you be sure to talk to Cohen Paulusma in the Netherlands about the time I spent in a friend's garage with a blender and samples of Amish poop. Okay, because he's got those samples in his freezer. He'd better have those samples in his freezer. Okay, so there we go, and I bet that those samples are low in bile acids. The poop is low in bile acids, and that it's not a standard cholagenic diarrhea. But you're going to look, you're going to find out, and maybe I'm wrong. Anyhow, so what else happens to the liver that's being assaulted by these bile acids? Well, it's not being assaulted. The normal amount of bile acids is coming back to the transplanted liver, but it still doesn't behave right.
Well, we don't know whether the amount is normal or not, to start off with that.
You're not sure about that. Okay. Yeah. You're leaving that open.
Yes.
Okay. Let's just say that something is wrong in the feedback of the FIC1 deficient gut that leads to liver problems. And what are those problems?
Patients might develop steatosis.
Steatosis.
And inflammation. Yeah. And I was taught by you, actually, that it's not steatohepatitis.
It can be steatohepatitis, but initially it's a very bland steatosis. And what happened back in the day, and allow me to stroke my long white beard when I say this, back in the day, it used to be fairly frequent to obtain liver biopsy specimens in transplanted livers shortly after the liver had been put in. Rule out rejection. The kid had an enzyme bump and you got a biopsy. And in the Amish kids who had transplants, within a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, after the new liver went in, it had been turned into something you could spread on a cracker, foie gras. The steatosis was panlobular and incredibly massive. So something is wrong about the livers. Something is wrong with the signals that are coming from the gut or with the liver's handling. You, in your presentation, tell us that that administration of an uptake inhibitor blocked diarrhea. So, no, you can't just nod your head at me. This is
yes, who it does.
Okay. We forget that we're not on a Zoom call, don't we? So, in that case, then those bile acids didn't make it through into the gut and went down into the colon. You'd expect that your inhibitor, if it were a cholinergic diarrhea, would make the diarrhea worse, or?
In the beginning, yes. This is what you would assume, but what you actually do when the effect is not something to be expected right away, but after a few weeks or 2 months' time, you would see that the diarrhea gets better.
And it takes a while for it to get better.
And I think what happens is that you deplete the enterohepatic circulation day by day, bile acid by bile acid, from bile acid. So you reduce the overall amount that is being recirculated. And eventually you hit a certain threshold and the diarrhea gets better.
Aha, okay, adaptation over time. All right. What happens to the steatosis? I'm not reading your liver biopsy specimens anymore, so I'm not sure if you're obtaining biopsies to assess that, or if you're doing it only with sonography.
So when I speak for the patient cohort that is within that presentation.
Six patients, yes.
It's a mixed population. So the patient from Innsbruck actually has received biliary diversion after transplantation because he had diarrhea and steatosis. And this diversion led to a resolving of the steatosis, but not of the diarrhea. So in our case, we did not have steatosis in the first place when we initiated the treatment.
Right.
But for some other patients, steatosis also got better.
Hey, you've got...
But not followed by histopathology, I'm sorry, just by biochemical liver.
Georg, you disappoint me. Okay. Steatosis gets better by biochemistry. I'm not going to believe that. I want a slide.
Ultrasound.
Ultrasound, okay.
But at least the inflammation is something you better can read out with.
And the inflammation, the inflammatory biomarkers also recede.
Yes.
That sounds like news that we can use, that people taking care of these patients can actually deploy clinically to great advantage. For the kids beforehand are nothing but canaries. Every time a canary hops from one perch to another in its cage, it lets go a little squirt. And those kids poop and poop and poop. It's miserable having to live in diapers, particularly when you're trying to go to school.
Yeah. In other words, this is what we refer to quality of life.
And quality of life, yeah, quality of
to
life.
To be smartly put, but this is... This is a very important point. If you cannot participate in your daily activities of life, being at school, being in some sport activities, because you always have to change your diaper or be close by the next toilet, I think this is...
That's a misery, yes. One prolonged misery. Well, there are probably a lot of people out there who would like to follow your lead to administer these IBAT drugs and to make the lives of their patients and their patients' families a lot better. What should they do? Do they have to be part of an official program? Should they approach you and see if you can give them a protocol and sign them up as participants in a study?
Well, they can always approach me, but I think many other centers are doing that or started doing it. Some centers, when they could not avoid liver transplantation anymore just because they wanted to avoid all these problems they might arise after transplantation, what they did was to preemptively perform surgical diversion at the moment of liver transplantation, because they probably have made a terrible experience with children even dying after transplantation because of severe diarrhea and sepsis and so on. And now with the availability of these drugs, some centers switch to initiating bile acid reuptake inhibition just at the moment of transplantation, but not performing internal diversion or external diversion surgery anymore.
I didn't know that. As a matter of fact, I thought that your presentation at ESPGHAN was one of the first ones to come to public attention. Is this all going on under the radar?
No, it's not under the radar. I think you have to meet the right people. And I heard Richard Thompson from King's say that they particularly switched to IBID inhibition after transplantation and instead of diversion surgery. I talked to Ema Fitzpatrick today. She's doing that or taking care of the patients who are transplanted at King's. I think this is probably an open secret, is not the right word, but probably it has not reached out to everybody, and we're just the only official case series advertising that idea. But it's not solely our idea.
Not solely your idea. Good ideas have any number of parents, and failures have none.
Just not to take all the credit.
I do want to suggest to the people who are listening to this podcast that if they're struggling with how to take care of these patients, that to monitor them in a carefully organized way with biomarker measurements and sonography, and although you've let me down, biopsy would be a very interesting project to take part in.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for allowing me to harass you about your presentation. And thank you for making yourself available. And we generally end these things with a piece of music that speaks particularly to the person being interviewed. Have you thought about what, it could be a song, it could be an instrumental piece that particularly not only touches your heart, but also speaks a little bit to what it is to be from that particular region of Austria that we call Tirol?
Yes, I did, but I have to let you down on that. This was just a piece of music I heard over the radio while preparing dinner. It was Beatles, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
If you would like to listen to the song in full length,
please check out our Espigan playlist.
Sergeant Pepper's, well, listeners, we hope you have enjoyed the show. If I may quote, thank you again.
Thanks for having me.